This is episode 200 of Inside Information, close to 2 million downloads, hard to believe. And as I look back on all of these episodes, I am so grateful to you, my listeners, and to my fabulous guests who made this possible. And I'm going to continue to interview great guests, but for the time being, I'm going to put this podcast on hiatus and instead interview guests on my Substack. It will still be free, you'll still be able to listen on demand, but you'll also have the option to listen live while I record, which means you can comment and ask questions. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Substack, this is the way it works. Substack is a platform for both written material, long-form videos, and live events. Once you download the Substack app, you can find my Substack by just putting in my name or Dr. Stryker's inside info. And I'll write this all out in the program notes with links to make it easy. If you choose to subscribe to my Substack, you'll get an email to let you know when there's a new post or a Substack live. Every week I post at least one written article. It might be a review of a newly published research, hot topic in menopause, or a piece about the history of medicine. Free subscribers get access to most of my content. Paid subscribers get access to all the content, the archives, and are also invited to attend my monthly Ask Me Anything webinar, where you get to ask me anything. Last week, someone asked me where I got my couch. Like I said, anything. These monthly webinars are attended by both healthcare professionals and non-healthcare professionals who are looking for high-level information. And if you don't attend live, you can listen to the replay on demand. And as a thank you to my loyal podcast listeners, for the next week, my paid Substack will be 30% off. The link to get the discount is in the program notes. So I'm not going away. Just for the time being, my interviews will be live on Substack instead of here. And in the meantime, I'm hard at work on my next book, which will be a comprehensive guide to menopause I'm writing in collaboration with AARP and Simon & Schuster. So stay tuned on that and some other projects in the works. My plan today was to do a replay of my favorite episode, but I couldn't choose one. I had about 50 favorites. Instead, I decided to replay one of your favorites. So I hope you enjoy revisiting as Dr. Stephen Goldstein and I discuss perimenopause, and I look forward to seeing you on Substack. The only thing predictable about perimenopause is that it's unpredictable and confusing. So it's not surprising that roughly one of four questions I get are about perimenopause. What is surprising and a little embarrassing is that in my almost 3 years of doing this podcast, I've only had one episode dedicated to perimenopause. I know. But today I'm going to make up for it because my guest, Dr. Stephen Goldstein, is one of the world's top experts on the science of perimenopause. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Before I get started, I'm very excited to let you know that I'm officially live on Substack. Dr. Stryker's Inside Info is a free Substack site where I'm posting solution-driven, medically accurate articles, guides, videos, podcasts, and live Zoom events to address all the specific things women face as they navigate midlife, perimenopause, and postmenopause. My goal is to be, well, a little edgy and sometimes funny, but I promise, just like my podcasts, all of my information is accurate and science-based. And in 2025, I am launching Come Again, the Essential Guide to Postmenopause Sexual Function. I've been working on it for 3 years, and I'm so excited to share it with you, only on Substack. So go to substack.com/@Dr. Stryker to subscribe. substack.com/@Dr. Stryker. Originally, I was going to write my own episode on perimenopause, but then I thought, why not just bring in the person who knows more about it than I do? Dr. Stephen Goldstein is a tenured professor at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine, the past president of the International Menopause Society, past president of the Menopause Society, the principal investigator on too many research projects to name, on the review board of multiple scientific journals, the author of over 200 papers, and basically an expert on anything having to do with gynecology, with a special interest in menopause and gynecologic ultrasound. Just to give you an idea,
His CV with his list of published works, academic appointments, and lectures is over 115 pages long. I got exhausted just reading it. And did I mention he's an inventor? And a really nice person who answers all of my questions, even the annoying ones. Welcome, Dr. Goldstein.
Welcome, Lauren.
The one thing I forgot to mention in my intro is that I'm like really insanely jealous that you are flown all over the world to speak at conferences. You were just in Australia, right? Melbourne?
Yes, I was in Melbourne at the World Congress of the International Menopause Society. There were 2,600 people, and it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, I was hoping it was going to be 2,601, but I wasn't. I did go a couple of years ago, but I wasn't invited to speak this year. So a little disappointing.
I tried.
I know. I get so many questions on perimenopause. And so what I did was I consolidated a lot of the questions I've been getting over the last few months and added some of my own. So let's just do this and see where we go.
Okay.
And the first thing, let's just be clear because I want to do some definitions here. Could you just talk about the difference between perimenopause and postmenopause?
Okay. So perimenopause, menopause, postmenopause, it's all very confusing to a lot of people. Menopause is the final menstrual period. Now, you never know the bleed you just got is the last one you're ever going to get. So we use a definition of no bleeding for at least 12 months as an arbitrary definition of menopause. Okay.
Okay, Dr. Goldstein, here's my problem with your definition, which is the official definition. But let's think about the roughly one third of the population that doesn't get periods. They've had a hysterectomy. They've had a uterine ablation. Maybe they have a progesterone IUD and they haven't had a period in 10 years, but yet they still have functional ovaries, but they don't have that last menstrual period to go on. So even though it's not the official definition, the definition I like is menopause is when you're no longer making estrogen. You know, what do you think about the fact? Because I always talk about the fact that that's really a definition that we have to revisit, yet it is the official definition. But we're talking one third of the population.
I don't know if it's one third of the people I see. Regardless of what the number is, you're absolutely right. If somebody is not getting leads because they've had a hysterectomy or they've had an endometrial ablation that was totally successful, and you're right, if somebody's not bleeding at all,
then you can't go by that last
menstrual. You need to go by symptoms. You can measure estrogen and you can measure FSH.
Okay, we're going to get back to blood tests in a bit. So what does it mean that someone is menopausal?
Once you're menopausal. You can use the word postmenopause or menopause, whatever. There's no more ovarian function. Perimenopause would be a time when there's erratic ovarian function. So we need to maybe review the menstrual cycle really briefly. You make estrogen for 2 weeks, then you ovulate. 14 days after ovulation, if you are not pregnant, you will have a menses. So to my patients, all the blood that comes out of their vagina is a period. But to me, a menses is a bleed preceded 2 weeks before by ovulation. If you don't ovulate, and we call that anovulatory, an from the Greek without, you make estrogen, but no progesterone. And if the estrogen fluctuates and is somewhat erratic, it can destabilize that lining of the uterus and people can bleed irregularly. So the hallmark of ovulatory normal cycles is their predictability, their regularity. The hallmark of these cycles without ovulation and ovulatory cycles is all over the map. Could be early, could be late, could be heavy, could be light, could be with cramps, could be without cramps, could be with PMS, could be without PMS.
Okay, but crazy periods are not the only symptom of perimenopause. So beyond unpredictable erratic bleeding, what are the symptoms that to you say, there's a good chance that this is perimenopause?
There can be an exacerbation of what I call the psychosocial symptoms. Some of these women will see free-floating anxiety, inability to concentrate, sleep disturbances.
So it seems that there's really two categories of symptoms of perimenopause. There's the erratic, unpredictable bleeding, but there's also mood swings, anxiety, depression, emotional ups and downs. And just like periods, those symptoms can come and go. So the challenge is to know if what you're experiencing is perimenopause versus you just legitimately hate everyone around you. So earlier you mentioned blood work. Women are often told to get an FSH or estradiol level. Is a single blood test helpful in terms of figuring out if someone is perimenopausal or postmenopausal?
I mean, that's just a snapshot of what's happening that day.
Well, exactly. These women get misled because if at 2 o'clock on Tuesday, their estrogen level was normal when they got their blood drawn, then the doctor calls them and says, you're not in perimenopause, when in fact they were. So what I want to know from you is, in general, we tell people don't get blood tests because it is just going to be a snapshot. Having said that, there are circumstances in which it's going to be useful.
I think it works 100% in one direction, and it works not quite as well in the other. And what I mean by that is, if you do get blood work and estrogen is up and FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, is down, a woman is not menopausal. She may well be perimenopausal and have very fluctuating levels, but she's not menopausal. If, however, her FSH were very high and her estradiol were very low, I never tell these patients that you are menopausal. I say your blood work was in a menopausal range.
Yeah, which is
different.
Because
a lot of these patients will have a blast of some ovarian function down the road. That becomes more difficult because that's a great segue into the treatment for perimenopause, in my opinion, is very different than the treatment for menopause. And I think that there are too many clinicians, and I think a lot of them are well-meaning internists who want to do women's health, who think that the treatment for perimenopausal patients is an estradiol patch and some progesterone.
Right.
Whereas if there are intermittent hot flashes and night sweats, that will certainly take those away. That doesn't suppress ovarian function the way low-dose birth control pills will.
Which is so confusing for women because they have this idea in their heads that birth control pills are, quote, low dose, and hormone therapy is somehow high dose, as opposed to the exact
opposite way around.
Opposite. Right. And the purpose right. of taking the birth control is to take these crazy fluctuations and right. suppress them.
Well, and I mean,
but how many times have you had women who come to you, and this happens all the time, and people will message me and say, I'm so angry. I went to see this menopause expert and they just wanted to put me on birth control pills. I hear that all the time. And then it wasn't because they didn't get an explanation. So please give an explanation to these
women.
We
don't treat menopause with birth control pills. The key in perimenopause is to suppress the ovarian function that's erratic and substitute that small amount of estrogen and progesterone that's contained within the pill that they take. So, for instance, there are myths about birth control pills that need to be dispelled. One is, and a lot of this is an inappropriate extrapolation from the Women's Health Initiative, what's in a pill? Estrogen and progesterone. So a woman looks at the pill, it contains estrogen and progesterone. And then she looks at her breast. Then she looks at the pill and she looks at her breast and she thinks, why would I put this in my body? What isn't explained is she's making a lot of hormone. That pill works by turning off her ovarian function and substituting. So this is suppression and substitution. It's not on top of what she makes.
That's
right. It is now instead of what she makes.
That's
and there's good science that in the lowest dose pills, that's less total effective estrogen than what she can make on her own in perimenopause, because you see less growth of fibroids and less growth of endometriomas on a low dose pill than women who are getting their own ovarian function.
Well, not to mention that the data is very clear that women who take low-dose birth control pills for over 10 years have a dramatic decrease in ovarian cancer, because it's basically giving the ovaries a rest. It's
actually not only ovarian.
Well, uterine also.
So I would refer you to an article written in 2000 in the New Yorker magazine by Malcolm Gladwell, famous author of Tipping Point, called John Rock's Folly.
I know that
John
article.
It was John Rock's Error.
Oh, John Rock's Error. I thought it was John Rock's Folly.
And 24 years ago, a non-physician told us that the use of birth control pills for 10 years would reduce ovarian cancer 70% and uterine cancer 60%. And I show that information that I presented at the Menopause Society this past September to many, many patients. But then I say, I don't know that it's fair to show you stuff that's 24 years old from a non-physician in the New Yorker magazine. There was a large study in 2021 out of Britain that looked at their bioregistry almost a quarter of a million women, and they compared never users of birth control pills with ever users of birth control pills. And the odds ratio, for those who don't know what that is, if an odds ratio is one, that means it's the same as. If it's below one, it's a reduction. There was a 20% reduction in breast cancer. There was a 43% reduction in ovarian cancer and a 57% reduction in uterine cancers, all statistically significant with p-values of 0.001. And the longer women took the pill, the more the reduction. So these, well, part of the thesis was John Rock, they should have brought these things out as cancer reducing agents. Well, not as
yet, I've always said we have to stop calling them birth control pills.
I call them hormonal cycle control.
And what was it?
I call it hormonal cycle control. Yesterday,
I call it hormone. That's good. I like that because I've always called it, you know, perimenopause hormone therapy and cancer reducers. But right. People don't know that.
Yesterday, I gave a 10 microgram birth control pill to a woman whose husband has a vasectomy. And I laughed because I said, you know, she's not the first. And as I said, I'm giving you this for hormonal cycle control, obviously not for contraception.
Don't be so sure. 30% of people have, I'm just saying, other partners.
Right.
There's that. That's
no judgment here.
No judgment.
We talked about it. It is suppression and substitution, not on top of. We talked about cancer reduction. The other thing that I talk about with all patients, because occasionally I have people come in and they don't want to take pills because they say it's not natural. Yeah. And the people who feel this isn't natural need to understand that we are higher order primates. Nature thought you would have 8 kids. You would have to nurse them all for 15 months. There's no bottle or formula in nature. Along the way, you'd have maybe 2 or 3 miscarriages. So if you do the math, most women have about 40 years of reproductive life, roughly age 11 to 51, 13 lunar months in a calendar year, that's 520 cycles. Modern women are often having 480 or more cycles. Nature thought maybe you'd have 250. And that's one of the reasons why in modern industrialized nations, these cancers are on the rise because women are cycling too much. So if you don't need the egg, you don't need the cycle because you don't want to be pregnant, suppressing it with birth control pills is actually closer to natural than what we have socialized into.
I once read an article that if you use that kind of calculation and take it back to cave times, because life expectancy was so short that most cave women maybe had 3 periods in their life. You know, they'd have their kids, they'd be nursing them, and then they'd die. So,
well, the other thing to realize, and this is really important when we talk about anything in terms of vaginal atrophy and genitourinary syndrome and menopause, other higher order primates, they live like a year or two after they stop reproducing. My patients are going to spend at least 40% of their lives in a post-reproductive
state. That's right. I think whales, there's one species of whales that lives long after menopause. All the others die.
Primates,
right. Okay, so when we talk about perimenopause and the mysteries of perimenopause and a lot of women who are really having a difficult time, and we're going to get to how to make that difficult time less difficult. But when we talk about that, of course, the question they have is, how long is this going to last? How long am I going to be like this? And I have not really seen any great literature on that because I think so often it's underdiagnosed, particularly in younger women, which I also know is an area of interest of yours and we're going to get to. But before we get to how long it lasts, I do think it's worth pointing out that, to my knowledge, the only people that don't experience perimenopause at all are women who have surgical removal of the ovaries, and they go right from premenopause to postmenopause. They don't really experience peri because they don't have any hormone fluctuation.
I think what you're describing is you cannot go from regular ovulatory, you know, reproductive function to being done without passing through a phase where there's going to be some lack of ovulatory function. That phase is going to be defined as perimenopause.
Right.
How long that lasts and how symptomatic, whether it's the bleeding aspect of the symptoms or the psychosocial aspect, will be totally variable and will follow a bell-shaped curve just like everything else.
Okay, so what's the range of your bell-shaped curve?
Well, I think the average is 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think it can range from almost nothing to 10 years or more.
I read an article that PCOS tends to go into menopause later because they're not depleting their eggs, their follicles. They're just sitting there because they're not ovulating very much. But I've never seen that reproduced in any other
studies.
Yeah,
I don't think that I would go with that either because, you know, the atresia of follicles really has nothing to do with how much you ovulate. A lot of patients will often ask, you know, if you suppress the cycle with pills for many, many years, will that delay menopause because you haven't used up the eggs?
So I think that's an important concept because you said the word atresia, and I think people get this idea that you run out of eggs and that's why you go into menopause. It's not that you've used up your eggs, is that your eggs are aging and no longer functional, which is basically atresia of these eggs, correct? Am I framing that right?
If what you're asking me is, are there, it's really the follicle that makes, it's not, you know, we use the word egg.
Right, but the egg is in the follicle.
That's making the estradiol. And basically, yeah. once you're menopausal, there are no more follicles. There's no more estradiol being produced by the ovaries.
But those millions of eggs that you were born with, they're just kind of like quietly sitting there.
They're gone. Like, they're done.
They're done. All right, so you said during a recent lecture, less than 1% of follicles are relevant to reproduction. The other 99% are required for function as an endocrine organ. Can you explain that so that the world understands? Because I think that's such an important concept.
If you think about, you know, if you were to ovulate every single, you know, 13 lunar months in a calendar year for all 40 years of menstrual function, but you're talking about maybe 500 ovulations in a lifetime, whereas you're born with like a million plus eggs.
Right.
So most of those follicles that contain an egg never have anything to do with reproducing per se, but they're making hormones.
They're making hormones. I mean, I think that's the point, is that these follicles are responsible for providing hormones.
Right.
Which circulate throughout the body.
That's a very good segue also into an important point. 20 plus years ago, I wrote the first textbook of perimenopausal gynecology with Nanette Santoro. And Nanette did a very interesting experiment that showed something that was not intuitively obvious, but is true, which is in perimenopause, estrogen levels actually go up before they go down.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think so. Most things in life, you know, you're at a certain level and there's a gradual diminution until something goes away. But what happens is when people stop ovulating on a regular basis, they don't develop what we call a dominant follicle. A lot of follicles make a lot of estrogen, and estradiol levels can actually go up before they go down, which is so interesting because, you know, 35 years ago or so, when I was a chief resident, we did maybe 4 hysterectomies a week at NYU Hospital for 49, 50-year-old women with rapidly enlarging fibroids. In reality, what was happening was as they made more estrogen, and this is before people were using ultrasound and they were describing the size of the uterus by fruit, you know, it went from being a lemon to being a cantaloupe. In 1 year, they got very nervous, and so they took it out. Right. And one of the reasons in perimenopause that you can see that kind of growth of fibroids is because estradiol levels actually go up before they go down in many, many, many women.
Which is why a lot of women, of course, have an exaggeration of symptoms like breast tenderness and moodiness. And, you know, it's this wild fluctuation in hormones because they do surge and PMS gets worse. I mean, it's a very special time of life. I think we'd all agree that.
I think the fluctuations in estrogen are the root cause of many, many
things. It's the fluctuation more than the actual level.
I wrote a layperson book called Could It Be Perimenopause in 1998.
You need to do an updated version of that.
It was just too early. You know, nobody knew what the hell it was and they didn't care. Well, actually, as a great aside to that, Lauren, when I was president of what used to be called North American Menopause Society, if I was at a cocktail party and speaking to a number of women who knew I was a gynecologist, if I mentioned I was president of the Menopause Society, it cleared the room. They didn't want to hear it. They walked away backwards. Now people can't get enough menopause.
Yeah, now you're very popular. I know that's what always kills me is that I'm always saying, you know, menopause is having a moment and it's, you know, so popular. And I'm like, I've been talking about this stuff for decades and nobody was interested. And all of a sudden now every single person is an expert just because they know, you know.
Well, you know, that article by Susan Dominus a year and a half, the very end of the article, she said, I finally found a doctor who treated my perimenopause with low dose birth control pills. And it was like life changing. You know, I started that in 1998.
Yeah. Tell the story of how you discovered that birth control pills are sometimes the best way to treat perimenopause.
Well, what happened was we were doing a large study on women between 35 and menopause that had any irregularity to their bleeding cycle. We studied over 400 women.
And what year was this?
It was published, I think, in 1997. 79% of the time, there was no anatomic abnormality. What we would tell patients is hormone.
No, so no fibroids, no polyps, right, nothing. No, everything
exactly,
was
no,
fine.
Exactly. No fibroids, no polyps, no precancer. That totally pristine uterine cavity. Their bleeding was, you know, hormone imbalance, what we now would call perimenopause, erratic production of estrogen. Okay.
Right.
When you talked to these women, the number of these women who were experiencing free-floating anxiety, mood swings, brain fog, inability to concentrate, memory changes, sleep disturbances. And the number of these women who were being put on Prozac, which was very popular in those days, they were told, oh, your husband had an affair, your youngest is going to college, you didn't get the promotion you deserved, here, try this Prozac. When we straightened out their hormone imbalance with low-dose birth control pills, the improvement in some of these women was dramatic. Some of these women, believe me, needed the Prozac, but many of these women improved. And now, like 26 years later, I'm at a point when a patient comes in with a list of complaints and some irregularity to her cycle and appears to be perimenopausal. What I'm saying is, you know, I don't really know how much of how you feel is hormonal, but I know how to find out. Because if she's a non-smoker, if she has normal blood pressure and she's never had a blood clot and she's a good candidate, I say a 2-month trial of turning off your ovarian function and substituting a very low, steady amount of estrogen.
Let the pill do the talking.
Exactly. Low-dose birth control pill. You will tell me how much of how you felt was hormonal. If this, this, and this gets 80% better, that was hormonal. Didn't touch that, that wasn't hormonal.
Yeah.
I've given up predicting who's going to do well and who isn't.
You know, it's so interesting because I was a guest on someone else's podcast and I was talking about this concept. And then the little snippet she used on social media, basically, I said, all these women are being prescribed SSRIs when what they really need is birth control pills. And I got blasted because people didn't understand it. That's the problem with social media. But I'm so glad you explained that because there is so much misunderstanding about that. I tell women that if they're doing well and they don't have any reason to go off, that they can stay on their pill until 55. Is that
so? That's a great question that comes up all the time. If you put people on a low dose pill, you know, the question comes up, well, how will I ever know if I'm menopausal?
Won't. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Well, yes. But so, and the chapter in that textbook that I wrote with Nanette Santoro, there was a chapter on the use of birth control pills in perimenopause, which was written by, you may remember, Patsy Sulak.
Mm-hmm, sure.
She advocated keeping everybody on till 55 because by then 95% of women would be menopausal. And I've never really bought into that across the board. I like to individualize because the reason we see people periodically is if they had significant symptoms, they're feeling great, I will continue them further. But, you know, if they're obese or their hemoglobin A1C is creeping up and they're pre-diabetic, in other words, on a case-by-case basis, and what I do is you have to stop the pills. I usually stop for 2 weeks, measure estradiol and FSH. If those numbers are in a premenopausal range, I say it works 100% of the time. I say you're not menopausal. Go back on the pills for another 6 or 12 months. If it's pointing towards menopause, I do not tell them they are menopausal. I say your blood work was in a menopausal range. I give those people a slip for a blood test. And I tell them if in the future you have any bleeding, do the blood work first and then call me. Because what happens in this country too often is if you have blood work on your chart that looks menopausal and 3 months later you have a bleed, you will get a workup for postmenopausal bleeding.
Well, that
and
was
if
actually,
I can document that they had a blast of ovarian function, then they're in late perimenopause and I don't have to work them up for postmenopausal bleeding.
Very often, you know, women are told if you've been 12 months without a period and if you have any bleeding at all, you need to immediately call so we can do an evaluation to make sure that there's not a precancer or a cancer. And it's not like your uterus read the menopause manual and knows that in 12 months it's time up. And there can be people who have been without a period for 8 or 9 months and they're truly post-menopause and then they bleed at 11 months, and other people who might bleed at 13 months and it's just that one last hurrah of their ovaries kicking in. So it can be really tricky.
Right. You're absolutely right. No, what you just said is 100% correct. And, you know, you'd have to use a little bit of judgment. You also have to factor in things like a patient's individual risk factors. Is she obese? Is she diabetic? This is all part of the equation of what to do.
Well, right. And it's like this theme of individualizing care.
And the other thing is occasionally, though, you do get sort of sucked in. So, I mean, for instance, patient has numbers on the chart which were pointing towards menopause. Somehow she fell through my cracks, let's say, where she calls and says, last week I bled for 2 days. I swear it felt like a period. My breasts got tender. I believe them. My patients why would they not tell me the truth?
Right.
It sounds very much like they had a menses, but if I then send them for blood work and I'm still getting numbers that are in a menopausal range, then I will get sucked into some evaluation because what I've got is menopausal numbers, a bleed, and I still have menopausal numbers. So I'm a little nervous.
You want to be careful.
Like a menses. So that's why I give people the slip to have the blood work and say, do the blood work first, because a lot of times there's such fluctuations that if it's a week later, you know, by now, and they'll say my hot flashes went away, it's hard to rely on their input, you know, and not something if everything's pointing towards menopause.
But that's why when I talk about diagnosis of perimenopause and I say we generally don't do blood work, and then I follow that up with, but there are exceptions when it is useful, when it is helpful.
One thing that we're in total agreement on, though, I think, is once you are menopausal and you're on some menopausal hormone therapy, there is no need to follow levels. We don't follow levels of blood. We follow patient's symptoms.
Right.
It's too much variation. There's too much variation in the methodology of the different labs' kits of measuring this stuff.
Right. Now, the only time that I generally will get levels on someone who's on hormone therapy is if I'm giving them what I think are more than adequate doses and they're continuing to be symptomatic, particularly if I've got them on a transdermal. You know, some of those people just don't seem to be absorbing. But in general, if someone's doing fine, no, there's no way that I'm going to follow levels. Okay, switching gears. I heard you speak about women who are younger than average who are perimenopausal. And when I was a resident, we just never heard about that. It never came up. We were always taught that the typical time to be in perimenopause is mid to late 40s, occasionally early 40s. And it was the true, true outlier, we used to call premature menopause back then, who, you know, went to menopause before the age of 40. But in your lecture, you talked about that this is actually far more common than most people are aware. Women that are experiencing perimenopause and menopause in the 30s. And we're not talking about people who have chemotherapy. We're talking about just women who are generally healthy who go into perimenopause early. And I think the quote you said was that it is more common for women to experience menopause before age 40 than the incidence of the top 10 cancers. So I have a number of questions about this. One, do you think that this has always been the case? Or this is a newer trend? Do we even know that? And are there any women that's predictive?
I don't know if it's increasing in incidence or we're just getting better at observing it and following it and thinking about it. And the new lingo for is POI, premature ovarian insufficiency. That's before age 40. Before age 45 is called early menopause. POI, you have to start to think about a whole lot of other things. It's probably, in many people, an autoimmune process. And you have to look, there's a big association with Hashimoto's thyroiditis. You need to get thyroid peroxidase antibodies on those patients. You need to think about Fragile X premutation.
So a genetic predisposition, essentially.
And, you know, whether or not this is truly increasing or just our ability to observe and you know, think about it is increasing.
But the major point, of course, is aside from the fact that women are often blindsided and that it's very distressing to have these symptoms and to lose their fertility, but the repercussions and the associations that it has with long-term medical problems.
Bone, heart, vagina,
right. Far more than women who go through menopause at the average time or later. Well, and I think that, I mean, that's what really I think is the take home message here, is that a lot of women who maybe are in perimenopause or menopause before the age of 40, and they are inappropriately told, oh, well, bad luck, goodbye, you know, have a good life, instead of being told you are at a significant increased risk for things that are going to impact not just on your quality of life, but on your length of life.
We sometimes have been criticized for the so-called medicalization of menopause, that it's a natural event that all women are going to go through, blah, 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 blah. And you know as well as I do that, you know, there are sequelae of that that we would like to prevent. Premature ovarian insufficiency should be thought of really as a disease state, as you're now pointing out. In other words, you stop making estrogen prior to age 35. You need that replaced until you're 51.4, no questions asked. And any preconceived notions that you have about the pros and cons of menopausal hormone therapy, those are the typical women who go through at the normal age, okay? And I think we all understand what the risks and benefits of that are. But if you have premature ovarian insufficiency, you really need to give back that woman her, you know, and not just the kind of dose you would use on a 51-year-old. You've got to use much higher doses of hormone.
But I think that was going to be my next question.
Protect their bones, their heart, their brain, their whatever.
Right. Are you going to really prevent these long-term issues by giving her your typical low dose of hormone therapy, which is not replacement? That's why we don't use the word replacement. It's low doses.
I guess what I'm trying to say, and didn't come across clear enough, is that even if you don't want to medicalize menopause, and you believe that natural menopause is
this is not natural.
True. This is a disease state. This is something that needs to be treated. And so women who have this need to understand that any preconceived notion they may have about hormone and therapy doesn't apply to somebody who's 34 who now makes no more estrogen. Until they're 51, they're simply catching up with their peer group. You're trying to give them what their peers are making on their own.
Let's talk about the woman who is not having irregular periods or bleeding that's bothersome to her. She's just having all these other symptoms, the brain fog, the anxiety. And we certainly talked about birth control pills as being one way to manage that. Do you ever give low dose hormone therapy to manage those symptoms in a woman who is just feeling terrible, but her periods are not the issue?
I would still use low dose birth control pills. You have to realize people are getting better at tracking their bleeds. They seem to have it in their phone. And the first thing I do with a new patient, I will ask them for the first day of their last 6 months of bleeds. And actually, I'm pretty good at math. I'll sit there and calculate it. So if it's like 27, 27, 26, 27, 28, 27, that woman is ovulatory. Okay. That she is so regular, she's clearly ovulatory. Yeah. If it's 27, 42, 19, 27, 17, 19, 41, she's ovulated two of the last 6 months. I don't need anything else to tell me that. If you bleed on day 19, you did not ovulate on day 5. That's easy. But sometimes the variations are a little more subtle. You know, I have the luxury of the fact that I'm doing ultrasound on all these people. So, the what's going on in the ovary and what goes on in the endometrium will be corresponding to each other. And so what you've just described, you said, well, they don't have any bleeding. You know, they're not complaining of their bleeding. But a lot of times on day 23, if they clearly have not ovulated, they can still be anovulatory, not having what you would define as abnormal bleeding, but having these fluctuating, they can still have fluctuating levels of estradiol. So I still think that a 2-month trial of low-dose birth control pills in people will take anything potentially hormonal off the table. The problem with let's say a patch and progesterone is it doesn't prevent erratic ovarian function. It's just going to be on top of what she's
too low. All right, Dr. Goldstein. So Mrs. Smith walks into your office and she weighs 250 pounds. She's had a blood clot and she has not given up her one pack a day habit. And she is having all of these terrible perimenopausal symptoms. What are you going to give her?
She's tying both hands behind my back. Not just
a little black cohosh, maybe. I mean, I think from my point of view, it depends. I would say, what is your goal? What are the symptoms that are bothering you the most? It's very different for someone who perhaps has irregular bleeding and maybe an IUD is going to be the answer versus someone who's anxious and who's having a lot of problems with.
I don't know if there's any good data on what I'm going to say now, but it's been my impression, and I've been doing this for a long time, that perimenopausal people who have some of the symptoms that we've described tends to be an exacerbation of things that they tended towards previously. Yeah. So what I mean by that is, if their biggest complaint is their anxiety is off the charts, they were usually somebody with a little bit of anxiety always. Yeah. Or if their biggest complaint is sleep disturbances, they never were the best sleeper. I find that perimenopause tends to exacerbate whatever people have as underlying tendencies to start with.
Yeah.
And I guess in cases like that, you know, if you can't treat the woman hormonally, you're going to decide what the symptom is if it's sleep.
And that may be also one of the situations in which an SSRI is appropriate.
Well, I was just going to say. And the other thing is, it's hard to tease out, even in people where you clearly have fluctuating levels of unopposed estrogen, perimenopause. We also live in a very stressful time. And people are going through a lot of stresses in their life. So sometimes it's hard to tease out how much is hormonal and how much is living in urban America in 2000, almost 25.
We're not even going to talk about the election because I get in trouble every time I do. But is it menopause or is it midlife?
All hormonal or all non-hormonal. You know, there's a lot of interaction. I say to people, I don't know how much of how you feel is hormonal, but if they don't weigh 240 pounds and then smoke a pack a day and have high blood pressure and had a VTE, I know that I can figure out how much is hormonal by shutting it down for 2 months.
Yeah, no, I get that. So we talked about this irregular bleeding that women have during perimenopause. When is it okay to ignore it? And when does someone have to check in with their doctor or other clinician?
Well, if you look at like ACOG guidelines, any woman over 40 who's having irregular bleeding should really have endometrial evaluation.
Meaning start with an ultrasound.
You theoretically could start with endometrial sampling, which I would not do, but people sometimes still do that.
Some people call it a pipe collar and endometrial biopsy, just so everyone knows what we're talking about.
And understand that, I really got involved in this. There's a difference between biopsy and sampling.
Right.
What you're doing is endometrial sampling, okay? And it's blind. So even the word sampling implies that you're taking a small piece that's representative of the whole thing. Like if you take a water sample from a reservoir, you assume that that's indicative of the entire reservoir. We take a sample of the endometrium, you don't necessarily have honed in on the area. So if a woman has a polyp or a woman has focal hyperplasia,
which is a precancer
in some
women,
precancer, you don't get a piece of the right spot, you will be misled.
Because it's just a sample. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, the reason why we're evaluating bleeding is because we want to know if someone has a precancer or a cancer, or can we be reassured? There has been an increase in uterine cancer in Black women, and it's also more likely for Black women to have funky bleeding during perimenopause because we've already established that fibroids can grow and bleed. So it's confusing. What is your message to Black women?
Kimmy Dahl wrote an article that got a lot of publicity about this less than 3 millimeter endometrial echo not being reliable in Black women because they have a higher incidence of fibroids and they have a higher incidence of what we call type 2 cancers, which is papillary serous as opposed to the typical glandular cancer, adenocarcinoma of the uterus. If patients have fibroids and you don't see the endometrial echo well enough, you cannot use ultrasound. So right off the bat, the fibroid issue is diffused. In other words, you've got to be able to see the endometrium on ultrasound beautifully from where it takes off at the cervix all the way to the top. And it's got to be distinct in order to use that measurement to exclude something bad. If you have a Black woman who has none of these typical risk factors for cancers, adenocarcinomas, and she has a bleed and she's got a thin echo, that's when perhaps your index of suspicion for a type 2 cancer ought to come up. And maybe you want to do more than just look at a simple endometrial echo.
Oh, that makes sense.
I think the other, of what I'm saying, in other words,
it's tricky because you need to understand someone's risk factors. But I think the other thing that's important to emphasize is if someone tells you it's just your fibroids and that's why you're bleeding so heavily all the time, that you can't just ignore it, that it needs.
You can't ignore. Obviously. I mean.
Well, you say obviously, but it happens all the time. Women are brushed off and they're told, of course you're bleeding. You've got fibroids.
The other thing, there was just an article and something like 37% of menopausal women did not realize that bleeding in menopause is a risk for having endometrial cancer.
Right.
Something like 47% of women.
Because they don't see gynecologists, for one.
Said if they had one episode of bleeding, they wouldn't even let their healthcare provider know about it unless they bled again. In other words, this is
All right. So let me ask you a tough question. You're not going to like this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. You know, this morning, this is true. A friend of mine called me to say, I'm really worried. I had an ultrasound. She's postmenopause on hormone therapy. And she said, I had an ultrasound and the doctor is really concerned and wants me to have an immediate DNC because there was a polyp. And I said, really? And I'd never heard of this particular doctor. And I said, can you send me the report? And she sent me the report and it was the most inadequate ultrasound report I've ever seen. It was ridiculous. I mean, all of the things that you have taught us so well to look for in a report. And so what I basically said to her, she said, you know, what's your opinion? And I said, my opinion is you need a new gynecologist and you need to get a different ultrasound. But the point is that everyone assumes that an ultrasound is an ultrasound is an ultrasound, and is one of the world's foremost gynecologic ultrasonographers and experts in reading ultrasound. How is a woman supposed to know if the ultrasound that she is getting, when she's told, don't worry, ma'am, everything is fine, how is she going to know that this was an adequate ultrasound? Are there anything?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you could make the same comment about breast imaging, these things that are operator dependent. We have our advanced ultrasound course this weekend here in New York, and I run the GYN day, and I'm giving a talk called Tips and Tricks to Improve Your Gynecologic Ultrasound. And one of them is GYN ultrasound is not a laboratory test. For instance, if you do a blood count, it doesn't matter if I did it in New Jersey, I do it in New York, might get 37.9 as a hematocrit at one place and 37.2 in the other place, but you're not going to get 27.
Yeah.
Ultrasound is only as good as the equipment and the person doing it. And you're absolutely right. There's some really mediocre stuff out there, some really mediocre interpretation of stuff out there.
Yeah.
And it's scary. I see this almost every new patient who shows up in my office today has been mismanaged somewhere else, either hormonally or by their ultrasound.
Yeah.
I mean, it's scary. It is.
And it's hard. I mean, I tell people as a generalization, and this is a generalization, of course, there are exceptions, that if someone is doing it in their office and they're not you and don't even do a transvaginal, that's a big red flag. And in general, I think in major academic centers, you're going to get more quality control in terms of the machine and the technician who's doing it. But it's a tough one. But I tell people don't panic. Sometimes, you know, talk about getting second opinion. Sometimes you need a second ultrasound as opposed to
before you're going to have surgery anyway, that's for sure. You know, I thought you were going to ask me about, realize that the number of postmenopausal women who have an asymptomatic non-bleeding polyp is 13%.
Yeah.
That's 1 in 8 women. So, and they're often discovered incidentally.
She wasn't bleeding.
They think somebody's having a kidney stone. They do a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. There's no kidney stone, but there's this thick thing in the uterus. And then she has an ultrasound and they tell she has a polyp. She hasn't bled in 20 years and they want to take it out. They took out 1,152 polyps in a row in Italy that hadn't bled. There was one cancer in a polyp.
Yeah.
There were three others that they thought were polyps on sonohistrography that turned out to be cancers that were just focal. But the incidence of serious complications approached 4%,
wow.
You know, perforation, difficult intubation. That's not good enough because we all have that occasional patient says, but I'm always the one.
Right.
You know,
right.
There was a guy in Germany named Gerber who managed to find 13 people who had cancer that hadn't bled because uterine cancer is very curable because it tends to bleed early.
Yeah.
If you report it and you
Right, it's a big red flag, which is why you don't ignore it.
He compared the 13 who had cancer with 169 people who had cancer that presented in the normal way with bleeding. And what he found was if you were treated within 8 weeks of your bleeding, your survival and prognosis was every bit as good as if you found it before the patient bled. So my patients with a thick non-bleeding endometrial echo discovered incidentally, I do nothing. I tell them if you have any bleeding, staining, or even brown discharge, you must call me. And they never do. But I'm saying this, you know, all we ever said, I mean, I wrote a paper like 15 plus years ago called The Endometrial Echo Revisited, Have We Created a Monster? And I didn't want to be as arrogant to say, have I created a monster? Because all we ever said was, if you have postmenopausal bleeding and you've got a nice thin white line in ultrasound, use whether you want to use 4 millimeters or 5 or 3, there's no tissue there.
Yeah.
Okay. If it's done well, what do people hear? Well, less than 4 is good. Greater than 4 must be bad. So somebody has an incidental finding of 10, 12, 15 millimeter endometrial echo. They haven't bled in 20 years and they want to do a D&C hysteroscopy. They want to do all kinds of stuff. Whereas 1 out of 8 women is going to have a polyp that hasn't bled, that's benign, that doesn't need to be removed, but she needs to understand if she has any bleeding, she needs to report it promptly.
That's right. All right. So my last request to you is, could you please update and publish, Could It Be Perimenopause? Women need this book. I'll even write it with you. We could co-author.
Write it with
Would that
me.
Be fun?
Yeah, you know what? Because I had a co-writer who was a real writer and she passed away.
I'm a real writer. I was an English major.
You know
did
what?
You know that? I actually write all my own stuff. A lot of people think other people
you know,
write
I'd love to do it. We should do it.
All right, let's do it.
Do you have a copy of the original one?
No.
I wonder if I should, I'll try to find one and send you one.
All right, I will look for that. Thank you so much for doing this.
Fun,
this was
Lauren.
A lot
You're the
of time.
Best. No, Lauren, you're the best.
But we covered a lot.
People should really be pleased at what you have done for women. I do it one person at a time, and I try to teach doctors and healthcare providers to do a better job. But you are a real voice of reason for patients.
Well, I learned from you, so thank you.
I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Inside Information books available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
The light. Now I'm sleeping through the night. High five.